everyone. I'm Evelyn.
And I'm Lara. We are the host of Once Upon a Niger podcast, where we take you down history lane as we break down stories about people, places, and events in Nigeria's past and present.
That's right. In every episode, we will take you on a journey of our own discoveries as we feed our curiosity and connect with our heritage. Join us to figure out how the chronicles of the past can help write tomorrow's tale. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Niger podcast. Your hosts today are Evelyn and Lara, speaking to you from the UK.
That's the energy. That's the energy we need.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Once Upon a Niger podcast. It's great to have you here. We are very grateful that you are listening to us. We don't take it for granted. We appreciate you taking time out of your day to listen to us. And if it's your first time here, welcome.
Welcome, welcome.
I don't always start episodes like that.
Evelyn's feeling very generous, like, you know, thank you for listening. No, we do appreciate you guys, man, honestly. Thank you for supporting us, and yeah.
Yeah, so let's get straight into it. So today's episode, we are talking about one of the presidential candidates for the Nigerian, and that will be happening in 2023. And we are going to be speaking about Atiku Abubakar. There's my... Can you see things are crashing and they're falling and because of struggle pronunciation? Apologies.
Atiku Abubakar. And for those who haven't listened to our first episode, in case you've just jumped straight to the second one, this season of Once Upon a Niger, we are going to be looking at the profiles of the presidential candidates for, you know, for next year's election. And we're going to be taking you through them. So obviously, first episode, we talked about President Buhari. So if you haven't listened, we'll encourage you to listen to that one and then come back to this. So, Abubakar, Atiku. We'll just call him Atiku.
This guy is... Last episode, we were talking about tenacity. You know, we're talking about the striving and the struggle to go after what you want.
This one has a first class.
He has a star.
Distinction.
In tenacity. This guy has attempted and is still attempting to become president of Nigeria. He's attempted to become president 5 times already and he's always failed. But he's not a newcomer to governance. He's not a newcomer to walking down the aisles of power.
Yeah, I mean, he has had a stint in Aserok.
Yes.
For eight years.
Because he was the vice president to Obasanjo. And he's an interesting figure in that, I guess when I look at his career, you know, just first thoughts on him is that, why don't you stop trying? Why don't you stop trying to be president? It makes me think that there is a problem with ego there. And I don't think that is what Nigeria needs.
What if he just thinks he's the savior? Like, he's the one with the answers to Nigeria's problem. Wouldn't you, if he was genuinely the candidate to restore Nigeria's sanity, wouldn't you rather he keeps trying? If I know you're the only person who can help me, I would rather that you keep trying to help me until I get the help that I need, no?
Yeah, but if we look at the reasons as to why he's even failed, maybe that will give us an indication as to why he's not won, you know? So I think let's start from the beginning of what we know.
Okay, back to Genesis, back to the beginning.
Yeah, so he's Muslim, mm-hmm, from the north, and he's actually been more well known as like a businessman, entrepreneur who has had like lots of success with oil. And in growing up, he yeah, he went into business, but then through that somehow managed to get into the circles of like top civil servants and start making a name for himself in the political sphere.
Just to say, he himself was a civil servant. He was a civil servant for many years, for I think about 20 years. So he worked in the Nigeria Customs Service for 20 years before rising to become deputy director, which is, I think, probably the second highest position in the service back then. He retired in 1989, then he took up full-time business and politics. But most important business came while he was a customs officer at the Apapa port. So what I kind of noticed is that he used his civil service position to enhance his businesses or to even perhaps create his businesses and create a profile for himself as a businessman. Because when I was looking into him, I wonder if he would have achieved the same level of success that he has now if he hadn't first been a civil servant with access to knowledge, to what, inside information, really, I
quite
think.
Frankly, yeah.
Quite frankly, and taking advantage of, you know, his position to enhance himself.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that his time, you know, in the customs office was an interesting one because that department was known for lots of corruption. Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere that he said that, you know, he didn't participate in the corruption. And to me, when I read that, I thought that's like saying I live underwater, but I don't swim. Like, how?
How did you survive?
How are you not part of that corruption, which, you know, is never really expanded upon?
Especially given his senior position, it was a bit rich for you to say, oh, it was going on, but I didn't take part. But it shouldn't be going on anyway, because you're the leader, you're the boss or one of the bosses, and you should have had a hold or control on how people were acting and the things that were going on. So yeah, it was a bit rich when I read that, actually. So some of his businesses, I think he founded the Nigeria Container Services, known as NICOT, which is a logistics company operating within the ports, which is, you're a customs officer. Then you go and create a business, a logistics business that was operating within the ports. Tell me, conflicts of interest. There's nowhere you work, even in the jobs I've had, you have to declare your conflicts of interest if it's in line with, you know, the job you're doing or has any sort of similarity or whatever the case may be. And I guess the lack of enforcement or the lack of regulatory framework, I don't know what it is, has really kind of aided and abetted him in just taking advantage, because he did create a business, and that business in itself provided great for him. And then he co-founded Intel's Nigeria Limited, which is an oil servicing business with extensive operations in Nigeria and abroad. And then he had other businesses in Yola, Adamawa. And to cap it all, he then founded the American University of Nigeria, which is the first American-style private university to be established in sub-Saharan Africa. What I don't quite remember is when this university was founded, but he was a civil servant the time he founded this university. And we must talk about the amount of money it costed to build, fund, establish this university as a civil servant. But
yeah, I mean, that's just a signal to his wealth, and it's a signal to his success. However he got it, whether you or not you think it's by legitimate means or not, and I think this has definitely helped him, you know, in his time, and had people be impressed by him, and a lot of people even today and his supporters will say like that's even the reason why we should have him as president. You know, not only has he had this success as an entrepreneur, but, you know, because he's got some experience in government, like, he's the person to bring both of those things together, especially when you have such a dire situation in regards to the Nigerian economy. Somebody who understands business, who understands, should be at the forefront.
So I guess with him as a businessman, he understands the role that politics plays in business. So he started to play the two games really well. And in the early 1980s, I believe he started to be mentored by General Shehu Musa Yar'Adua. And so this kind of gave him the foothold he needed in the political sphere. And eventually he contested to be governor of Adamawa State. But then in that time period, in 1999, he actually won the contest in 1999. But then Obasanjo invited him to be his vice president. So he had to step down. And this was how he became vice president in 1999. If in his current race to be president, He already has experience in democratic government, right? Governance. And I would want to look at his score sheets and be like, how did he do? I want to get references from his boss to think, would this guy be a good president?
Well, I think we can look at his first term as vice president. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, he is second in command, so the responsibility of those policies and the success of them does fall to Obasanjo. But I mean, he was involved in that, and obviously his job is to support that mandate. And I think his first term as vice president was like characterized by his overseeing of the sale of public enterprises. Mm-hmm. So he was the chairman of the National Economic Council and the head of the National Council on Privatization from 1999 onwards. But during that time, he actually made heavy losses. So that was like bad, obviously. And that isn't genuine, especially when you think of somebody who has had all this success privately. The hope would be that they would do well, and they didn't. So that's like minus one, like on the first term. Then you have second term, and even that was marked actually by quite a stormy and contentious issue with Obasanjo. And I think on that front, actually, I was actually more impressed, because that issue was around Obasanjo wanting to actually seek a third term as president. And Abubakar was like, no, like, you shouldn't, like, don't go forward with that. And it was actually quite a public dispute. And I think that is actually, like, reading that was very encouraging, actually, because it clearly there was a recognition that you can't continue like all the other big men of Africa.
Maybe that's because he wanted to be president.
Well, that's also true. That's also true. But for the sake of Nigeria, it's also good that we're not going to have, you know, just pretty politics, but like, you know, this unending rule of
course, because I think one of Obasanjo's rationale for wanting to go for a third term is that he said something about how, you know, Mugabe, Egypt's president,
the president of Libya, of Egypt, of Togo, of and Zimbabwe, they've all had their turn, and he's saying,
why should I leave them there? They were in power when I came in, and they're still in power when I'm going out. Why should I leave?
The guy's a joker, a big joker.
You know, now that I think about it, like, you know, cheeky, quite, you know, much, very much. And Abubakar had to say to him, we're not Togo, and we're not Zimbabwe. This is Nigeria, and it's time for you to go. And I wonder if that actually influenced his review of Abubakar in his book, because President Obasanjo wrote a book, and in that book, in 2014, he published a book called My Watch. And in that book, he said the following of Abubakar. He said, what I did not know, which came out glaring later, was his parental background, which was somewhat shadowy, his propensity to corruption, his tendency to disloyalty, is inability to say and stick to the truth all the time, a propensity for poor judgment, his belief and reliance on marabouts, his lack of transparency, his trust in money to buy his way out of, on all issues, and his readiness to sacrifice morality, integrity, propriety, truth, and national interest for self and selfish interest. I thought, yikes, that's not really a good reference for someone who was your vice president for 8 years and who is now looking to be president himself. You know, if we were to just go by reference alone, because obviously when you're going for a job, a new job, they want to get the reference of your previous boss to understand how you're going to perform. And that already in itself is quite condemning.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, in my view, that's just, you know, a former president, outgoing president being salty at the fact that he was there, like, challenged.
Yeah.
So I find it difficult to take that sort of comment seriously or like give weight to it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that was like, well, that was his experience, Obasanjo, at that time. And I think moving on from that, his time and his other attempts to become president are just marked by what seems to me a lot of like flip-flopping.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he is with PDP, then he goes to APC, then he goes to PDP, and back and forth, however number of times it is. Because when you're looking at this man's CV and the number of times he's going from party to party, it's ping pong, you know? Your head is bouncing from side to side trying to keep up with that. And again, to me, that says he's a man that doesn't remember his political face. Like, he doesn't remember what he looks like in the mirror in terms of what does he stand for?
So maybe Obasanjo was right then in some of the things he said, because, okay, so just a quick breakdown for the listeners. Between 1999 to 2007, he was Obasanjo's vice president within the PDP, People's Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Then he exited PDP in 2006 and joined forces with APC, I believe, which is the All Progress Congress. So in December, it was, well, Action Congress, actually, it wasn't even APC, it was called Action Congress at the time. So on December 2006, he was chosen as the presidential candidate of the Action Congress party. Then following the elections in 2007, Abubakar returned to PDP, and then in 2010 he announced his intention to contest for presidency, and I believe he has stayed with PDP since then. But you know, I think it was in the 1980s where they've had all these different parties, like it was part of the Social Democratic Party, and then, you know, there were different parties that were all merged together to mm-hmm. become Social Democratic Party, and I think that rightly fits into what you've just said about just the ping pong that it would supposedly have looked like. No, actually, then in 2014, he left PDP and he became a founding member of the All Progressive Congress, which is APC, with the ambition of contesting, you know, for presidency. And then I guess he left and then he went back to PDP. And now he's contesting under PDP.
Do you see?
But what that says to me is a lack of ideology. Yeah, all these parties are almost like they're one and the same. Because, you know, it's almost like in the UK, we've got the Labour Party, Conservative and Lib Dem is like the third party that's kind of like Labour Party currently in Nigeria. And it's almost like Boris Johnson, who was a Conservative, jumping from Conservative to Labour, to Labour, then become Lib Dem, then come back. And it's just like, because Nigerian political parties, for the large part, they lack ideologies. They're not founded on ideologies. They're just founded on power, power play. So it would make sense. So it's whoever has the most power currency is going to be But yeah, so that is Abubakar. And just to kind of like, I guess, to be in fairness to him, to kind of touch on the success that he had as vice president, many people give him credit for the success that they had with privatization in a way, particularly of the telecoms sector, where it was in that, obviously back in the days, there was Nitel, which is a public institution for telecommunication, where if you wanted to make a call, you would have to go to Nitel to make your call. Like all these things like mobile phones and stuff were not really that common at the time. And so during Obasanjo's regime was when telecommunications was heavily invested in Nigeria, and that development, I guess, sort of helped with Nigeria's economic growth. Okay. So, looking forward to the future, what is Abubakar promising Nigerians at the moment?
So, the first couple of areas that I could mention are the obvious ones around like insecurity and tackling the stagnant recovery of the economy. Those are a couple of areas.
And does he really give much detail as to how he's going to achieve these promises? But just before we delve deeper into the plan he has in achieving these things, another major area of his manifesto is restructuring. He intends to restructure Nigeria. So he's got like five key areas of focus, which he calls his five agenda that he's got. It's unity of Nigeria, security, economy, education, and devolving more resources and powers to the federating units, which has been, you know, there's a lot of discussions in Nigeria, or there's been a lot of discussions in Nigeria in the last couple of years about restructuring, because there's too much power centered in one area, and the idea is to give different states the power to make decisions for themselves and to be more competitive as well, and to take more charge of their own resources to generate wealth for themselves, and then for them to be able to use that wealth to further develop their states in accordance to whatever they need.
Yeah, and I think that's actually an important point, because I think with Nigeria being the size that it is, I think that it is a right point that too much power is centralized, and that's what leads to, is cronyism the right term? I'm not sure, but there's the distance between the center of government to what's happening locally for people is too vast. And for a country of 200 million plus, I think there is it's a valid area to tackle. Now, the appetite of that from the electorate is something that I think is...
I think there's an appetite for it, actually, especially in recent times, and because of all the stuff that has happened under Buhari's regime with insecurity. And so some states don't have as much resources to cater for their security, as it were. And it's due to lack of funds, because funds comes from the top, and different states, I imagine, receive different amounts of money, and so they have to manage their resources accordingly. However, if things are decentralized and more power is given to individual states, they would have more
autonomy.
Autonomy to do what they want. So I think it's a good idea, actually, because at the moment, you know, you have different states who are rich in certain natural resources, but it's just such a shame that they can't utilize it. And again, this kind of feeds into the whole Biafra, when the people who are fighting for Biafra, they're fighting, part of their reasons is because the oil that is generated from their states, from their region, is not really reflected in the wealth
of that region.
And so, you know, they start to question, what's the point? If we just go and go off and be on our own, then we can do what we like. And even now, you've got, even with the insecurity, you've got the Yoruba I forgot what they're called now. There's like the Yoruba people starting their own sort of like faction of security where they're going to like look after. I think it's called Amotekun, where they're going to have their own security forces, like private security to look after. So the conversations are already happening, and I don't think it's very far-fetched to think that somewhere in the near future that might actually become a reality.
Yeah, no, that doesn't seem surprising at all. And like some of the other promises that he's made, and one comment to make actually is that, you know, in doing research for this man and for other candidates, like sometimes even just trying to pin down actually what it is they are like campaigning for, just in a succinct manner, can be quite, well, it's not the easiest for me, because I feel as though I've been having to trawl through the internet to sort of like pick apart what it is that he's campaigning for. And I guess, well, I am not the main audience, because I'm here in the UK, he's not campaigning to me. But I think, I'm curious to understand how that relates to how he's communicating that to the people he wants to vote for him.
Yeah. Especially when you, that's a very fair point, especially when you consider the demographic and also the range of education, like how educated people are. And you think of like the market women, the illiterate, if you were, and how is this manifesto being communicated to them in a way that they will understand, and in a way that they can either say, I agree or I don't agree, and they can make an informed decision based on that. So yeah, it's not really the easiest information to find, and also to really kind of digest, depending on who the audience is.
But whatever we do find, we'll put that in the show notes for the listeners.
Yeah, but I think he has remained steadfast in his principle of privatization, because he is well known for supporting privatization. And I guess in terms of encouraging competition, because he thinks if you privatize, then obviously competition and, you know, all that good stuff. So on economy, he has reaffirmed the criticality of the private sector leadership and just greater participation in development, and how that's going to help with proposing like breaking the government's monopoly in all infrastructure sectors. And that's including like refineries, rail, transportation and power transmission. Now, on paper, this looks like a good idea. But then in reality, in the execution of privatization, because of past experience of, you know, people have accused them of just handing out national treasures to their families and friends, in quote, I'll be quite interested to see the level of transparency, what the implementation of that would look like. And also, we also know that privatization doesn't always work for everything. Like, you know, we're dealing with that in the UK at the moment with the what you call it. What's the oil and gas thing called? The people who supply
the energy crisis.
So we're dealing with that at the moment with the energy sector, where the energy sector was privatized and now the companies are making a lot of money. But whilst the economy is currently struggling, people still have to find the money to pay for them to have heat and water and whatnot, you know. So given the current economic structure of Nigeria and the level of poverty, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
And I think also, and to me, it seems as though that's the thing that he has going for him, or the thing that he mainly wants to position himself as the person that can grow the economy. But I mean, how much of the economy can, like, business can only thrive when there is safety, you know, like peace and prosperity come like hand in hand. And for this competition to grow, people need to feel as though that their lives are not in danger.
Yeah.
And I think that's the top priority. And I am just curious as to what his track record is. Or I guess maybe because he hasn't really... I don't think he's had many challenges regarding security during his tenure as like vice president. So I think that's something to pay closer attention to.
Definitely, because obviously it's one thing to say you're going to grow the economy and you're going to prioritize certain areas, but if people don't feel safe enough to come to Nigeria to invest in the economy, then, well, what are you really doing, you know? But just to your point about what he's going to do in terms of national security, so one of the things he said is that he's going to reactivate meaningful registration at birth as a way of reducing crime rate and protecting Nigerians. So I'm not quite sure, breaking that down, I'm not quite sure what that means. So I guess when you give birth to somebody, to a child, you have to register them at birth, mm-hmm. and it kind of tracks their existence.
Right.
Or it records their existence. But then that is not enough in and of itself.
I don't understand how that links to
national security.
National security.
Because it says that is going to, that's going to be a way of reducing crime rates and protecting Nigerians. I actually don't know, because I'm trying to read into this and think, does it think, because at the moment, one of the things that people complain about in Nigeria is that there's a lack of data.
Right, okay.
To track, to like easily identify people.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if he's going to authorize the process or make it a bit more...
just make it more efficient.
Digitized, yeah. And efficient, then perhaps it will be an easier way of tracking people and, you know, identifying and stuff. But another point that he made, he said he's going to rely on alternative approaches to dispute resolution as... again, it'll be interesting. So this is a kind of high-level summary of what he says he's going to do. But once you start to break that down and actually look into, like, the devil is in the detail, right? Like they always say. So it'll be interesting to see how he's going to do this thing. Also, we've talked about this earlier about, you know, decentralizing power. And I guess this might actually be a very fair point in that he's going to make state governments more viable as centers of development by decentralizing security institutions and promising to deal decisively with terrorism, kidnapping and other crimes. So I guess if he's going to decentralize security institutions, again, like we've said before, all these states have more control, they have more power, so they're able to deploy resources where they feel like it's most needed, as opposed to relying on federal policing or something. Yeah, so I mean, those are some of the highlights. And the other thing he did mention, part of his 5 points, is unity of Nigeria. Again, you know, there's so much tribalism, and even with this whole thing of being president, it's like, oh, you know, the northerners feel like it's our time, the westerners say, you know, the Yorubas are like, no, Emiloko. I don't know if you've heard about that. We're going to talk about Tinubu at some point. You know, this idea of like, oh, well, because of your tribe, you kind of have to keep passing the baton.
Yeah, the baton.
You have to keep passing the baton, you know, to each tribe until like everyone feels represented. However, I feel personally it should be about who can do the job, because it's one Nigeria. So it will be interesting to see how he intends to achieve that unity. So I think this are all, you know, these are all credible agendas to have. The fact that he is, because when I compare it to Buhari's, Buhari had like 12, 13 things he wanted to do. But I guess sometimes it's easy to just kind of have a shorter,
more concise agenda
and that people can say, oh, in his 4 years of governance, he achieved X, Y, Z, and they can actually, you know, speak of it positively, as opposed to you've got 14 and you can't even do one. So,
yeah. No, I mean, in terms of political strategy, fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I mean, what do the listeners think? We would be interested to like hear what they think about this, and if they know more about how he actually intends to. I'm sure there are interviews out there. You know, the one thing that I've noticed is that, and people have been complaining, is the lack of debate, like presidential debate. So at the moment, it seems like the other candidate, the Labour Party candidate, has been the only person, or the one who is most visible, kind of going out there you know, going to debates, going to interviews, talking, explaining how he intends to achieve, how he intends to be president and what he plans to do.
I mean, because maybe I don't know, maybe this is the cynical side of me, but I'm just like, this can they debate? Like, can they stand? Do they even understand their own policies, quote-unquote policies? Like, to me, I don't feel confident that they do. I don't feel as though they'll be able to stand on stage and not only defend their own position, but then scrutinise their opponents.
Yeah. And be scrutinised as
well. Yeah, and withstand it. And then you have also, I feel as though, I mean, with all sort of like debates around the world, you know, you feel as though the moderator of the debate isn't really, you know, keeping things fair or has the dexterity to manage a debate properly. But having said that, I think, you know, things should be done differently. So actually maybe it will be good, and it will be good to so that it would expose, you know, where they're lacking,
yeah,
and where they need to improve. But will that happen? Is yet to be seen.
And I think it's also a bit of a lack of respect for the people who are voting for them, because I think in a way you do owe it to the citizens to actually come and have a debate and be scrutinized. But I think many of them, you know, there's an idea that this is already a given, like we're either going to win this because they don't really think people's votes matter, and they've already got the people they're going to pay to, you know, to vote for them or whatever the case, the strategy they're pursuing. Yeah. In rounding up the conversation, what's your overall assessment of Abubakar himself as a candidate this time around, putting into consideration Nigeria as it currently, in its current state? Do you think he's going to be a worthy president?
The first thing that came to mind was just no. that was the immediate answer. And the reason why is because I think that I think I have a deep mistrust of people who flip-flop and who seem to be hungry for power. And so for me that means that I'm not particularly enthusiastic about him as a candidate. And I think that I mean, it's how do you demonstrate sincerity and authenticity and reliability and consistency, you know, of politics in, you know, one campaign period? I don't know. I'm not sure that can be done. But you know, it's not me who's voting. But I think from what I've read of him, known of him, I think perhaps if insecurity wasn't as big of an issue in Nigeria, maybe he would have been a more credible candidate. But I'm not really convinced or persuaded on the insecurity front, which I think is the top. There are so many competing things, but I think, you know, safety is the top priority. Yeah. And I think to be positioning yourself primarily from an economic point of view, albeit that is it's extremely important. I mean, people need to be safe and people need to be able to afford to eat. Yeah, it makes me like have doubts, because I think what this election is about, policy is one thing, but character is really actually, in my view, like, what is central to this, because we've just had decades of like leaders who have poor character, and that's what's important. So who the best character, who seems to want to really serve the people and not serve themselves, and Abubakar seems to want to serve himself.
It's interesting you say that. I get that, and I think it's very valid. But then I wonder to what extent does will character resolve the issues of Nigeria at the moment? Because when I go back to Buhari and the fact that many people voted him in because they felt that he had the character that they needed, i.e. the discipline, the kind of anti-corruption mentality. But then his wife, I don't know if you recall a BBC interview where his wife kind of hinted that he's not actually the one in the driving seat of power. His presidency has been hijacked. So you can have all the character that is required, but if you don't have the power currency, you might struggle to actually implement and execute the ideas and the policies that you have in place. You could be the, you know, you could have integrity, you can be kind in your heart and think, I want the best for these people. But because Nigeria's political sphere is a monster, it's actually a five-headed beast. Like, it's just a beast in itself, that you need someone who not only has character, but has power, can command authority in several areas. And that's because Abubakar has played with so many people across boards. I think perhaps he might have that currency in that area that he can, because he's
maneuver
himself, because he's joined PTP, he knows APC, or this, if he can. Yeah, so I don't know. But I think for me, as a final point, is I question his integrity. Just because I think it links to the character you've mentioned. I question his integrity just because I'm also aware that there's been a lot of scandal surrounding him. You know, there's been like, he's been accused of money laundering in America, where the accusation is that he sent like $40 million to his wife's account, and they've tried to do that via several vehicles. And the question is, you're a public servant. Yes, he's a businessman, but he's also a civil servant. Where did you get this money from? You know, when I mentioned the fact that he built a university earlier on, that was like $20 million at least to invest in that, to build that. Then the fact that the university has America in its name, he had to get license from like American University to, you know, to sponsor that. That in itself was apparently $8 million. So, you know, there's all this money going about funding different things and different things. And it's just a question of, where are they getting their money from? Can we trust him to have integrity? And I'm quite surprised that dealing with corruption is not part of his 5 points agenda, given the fact that corruption is such a big, is a massive beast as well in Nigeria. But yeah, so for our listeners, is Abubakar your man? Do you think he will be a worthy president? Can he solve Nigeria's problems? I wish you could see Evelyn's face in front of me right now. Yeah, let us know. Let us know what you guys think.
Yeah, so do, you know, message us on social media, send us an email. We'll be really keen to hear your thoughts, and we'll be following, you know, online with the latest as well about what's happening. And
yeah, and as always, share this podcast with your friends, your family, your postman, your markets, the person who supplies you with your tomatoes.
Lara's looking for any avenue.
Anyway, please. What's that, my phrase?
Support the ministry.
Yeah, you know, it takes effort to be producing this podcast. But no, thank you guys, as always. It's been a good discussion.
Yeah, so until next time, ciao.
So guys, thank you for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and learned a thing or two.
Yep, you can find our episodes on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to keep up with us in between episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at Once Upon a Niger.
You can also find links to some further reading and information about the episode's topic in the show notes. If you want to encourage, collaborate, or as I like to say, support the ministry, drop us an email at onceuponaniger@gmail.com. Bye for now.
Bye.